There have been 7 major debates for governor during the past 2 months, but this one is different. For tonight, citizens are taking the lead role. For the next 90 minutes, voters from around the state and here in the KTCA studios will question Norm Coleman, Skip Humphrey, and Jesse Ventura. The goal is informal discussion, no stopwatches, no podiums. We've encouraged the candidates to talk with each other.
Now, tonight's Citizen Forum event is the culmination of a year-long effort by KTCA, the Star Tribune, and NPR in association with KMOJ Radio and Insight News. For months now, hundreds of voters from all over Minnesota have been meeting via video phone lines. They've debated the issues and prioritized topics and questions for the candidates. Thanks, by the way, to the Video Conference Division of the Minnesota Department of Administration. These citizen groups are linked one final time. From Crookston, we welcome Dan Gunderson and the group that has assembled at the University of Minnesota campus there. From Lucille's Kitchen in Minneapolis, that site coordinator is Rusi Zulu. He's joined by a restaurant full of questioners. And from the campus of UMD, Jim Newman will be leading a group of Duluthians tonight. Citizens from southern Minnesota have found their way to the KTCA studios right here in downtown St. Paul. Joining this group is Lori Sturdivant with the Star Tribune. Lori is joined in the role of moderator by Karen Louise Booth of Minnesota Public Radio.
So let's get going. We suspect you know all the candidates by now, but it's impolite, and it'd be impolite not to introduce them. Norm Coleman is the Republican candidate for governor. Skip Humphrey, the DFL standard bearer. Jesse Ventura, the Reform Party candidate. Fellas, really thank you for coming down and your great cooperation throughout the campaign. Institutions are under attack, whether it's the church, whether it's pro sports, whether it's politics. Maybe John Glenn this week helped us realize that we lack contemporary role models. Is the governor a role model? And if so, how will that affect how you govern if you're elected on Tuesday? Mr. Ventura, start with you.
I think absolutely the governor is a role model. He's the top man in the state. He represents the state of Minnesota. You know, when dignitaries come from throughout the world or from other parts of the country, naturally the governor is there and plays that role as the head spokesman for the state of Minnesota. So certainly the governor is a role model, and you know, I think that it's an important task that the governor must uphold, and he has to hold himself, I will say this, to a higher standard than the regular people do.
Mr. Coleman.
Yeah, the governor, the challenge of leadership, Eric, is not what you do yourself, but really your capacity to tap into the energy of others, and to surround yourself with people of great talent, and then to tap into the hearts and soul and vision of the people of the state of Minnesota. And that's what I've tried to do in St. Paul, and I've learned that. So if you get to have the confidence of the people, they then take your vision and they move it to the next level. So in fact, that's part of the responsibility of leadership, to do things in a way that tap into the hopes and dreams of the people of the state.
Well, I think the governor is a role model of the first order, and I think it's not only in your official capacity, but it's also in your private life. It's your family life. It's the involvement and engagement in your community. It's not only the history of where you've been, but the vision that you have for the future, and that fits within your personal life as well as your public life. But the role of governor is very much an opportunity to explain to the rest of the world what Minnesota is all about. It is really the ambassador to the outside world, whether that's just outside of our state or whether it's all throughout the globe. That's what a role of a governor is, and so that person needs to not only take a look at what their own positions are in their public statements, mm-hmm. but you got to look at the way that they have lived their life and how they're involved in their family.
All right, gentlemen, thank you. Let's get right to our citizen questions right now. Tonight's first topic area is taxes. It's an issue that Rod Nelson from Winnebago, Minnesota, thinks about a lot. Here's Almanac's Mary LaHammer.
While property taxes in the metro area went down 4% this year, overall, greater Minnesota saw an increase in taxes. And outside Winnebago, Rob Nelson's family is facing even further increases. A proposed school levy would raise Rob's parents' property taxes by $600.
Most people will agree, even the superintendent of the school agrees, that the tax system is not fair and equitable to everybody. Agriculture, the way it is, can't support, you know, more and more taxes.
Rob works for the National Guard now, but he'd like to take over the family farm someday. He'd be the fifth generation in his family to farm this land, but he's worried.
Do you want to be the one that makes that break or not? Do you want to be the one to break away from the tradition and walk away from it all, you know? I don't think I do.
Rob, go ahead. My name is Rob Nelson. I'm from Winnebago. And my question is, since Minnesota is the second highest tax state in the nation, as governor, what are you going to do with the surplus? And what are you going to do to make government more accountable to us, the citizens?
First
of all, I think that since we have the surplus, and in addition to that, we have income coming in from the tobacco settlement, that first and foremost, we must return tax dollars to you in the form of permanent income tax cuts, as well as targeting families in need, such as your family and your farm family. But also, we need to make sure that we provide permanent property tax relief. I'm the only candidate that has put forth a plan that will provide more than $300 million worth of permanent property tax relief, and I've pledged to see that if we have an additional surplus that continues to come in the next, we'll know by the end of November, that's the next projection, that those dollars should be used to reduce the property taxes. I think that's terribly important. The other way that we can do this is to additionally invest those dollars in the public school system and in the formula. That will continue to reduce the burden on local property taxes, which all too often is probably going to force you off that farm. Now, the other thing that I think needs to be done for family farmers that are in distress right now is to immediately halt that payment of the property taxes in November. We have the resources. It's within a budget that can be made. And that will allow you to have that kind of dollars there to get into that next planting season.
We'll have a larger discussion on farm coming up. Mayor Coleman, how about you?
First, I truly understand the impact taxes have. We are the second highest tax, second highest in income tax, by the way, in the country. I am the only person running who has cut taxes. I've done that every year that I've been in office in St. Paul. When you cut taxes, what you do is you give people economic freedom. I think it raises a level of confidence. I think it's a key factor in generating new investment and new jobs in the community. And in St. Paul, we have over 8,000 new jobs since I've been mayor. In fact, another 1,000 announced today. But let me tell you what I'm doing. With that understanding in mind, that taxes take away economic freedom, I have laid out a very clear plan to cut taxes, $3.1 billion over 4 years. In addition to that, with the surplus, there is surplus money now, today. And part of my plan would put $500 million immediately back to Minnesota taxpayers. $150 million would go to Minnesota farmers to pay the first half of 1999 farm property taxes. And then your last part of that question is very important. What do you do with the surplus? And what you do with the surplus is you make sure it goes back to the taxpayer. We spend $23 billion on government. We should be able to deliver better service at less cost. The private sector does it all the time. And so if we get a surplus, it will automatically go back to taxpayers. They do that in Oregon, and we can do it here in Minnesota.
Jesse Ventura.
Well, I think it's very interesting. If you use Jesse Ventura's plan, you would already have money. Because I was the candidate that stood, the only one who stood at the steps of the Capitol and said, give the $4 billion surplus back, which would have come out to probably $1,000 apiece, roughly, for every man, woman, and child in the state. So I guess they can offer tax cuts now that they've spent that surplus on all their great projects and all the stuff they wanted to do, including then bonding us to the tune of $1 billion, which had both bipartisan support, Democrats and Republicans jumping in to do that. Well, Jesse Ventura's plan would have been you should have gotten that money back from day one because it did not belong to the government. That is surplus money above and beyond what they budgeted for, and they had no right to spend that money, but they certainly did, and now they're going to tell you about cutting taxes. That would have been the easiest money in the world. You'd have it in your pocket right now, and you wouldn't have to sit up here and listen to promises.
Friendly word to the candidates, the shorter the answer, the more citizen questions we get. And let's go to Crookston and get another citizen question. Crookston, go ahead.
My name is Milo Matheson from Mentor. Your political ads have not done much to help my cynicism. On the one hand, you pledge a commitment to the quality of our state, such as education. On the other hand, you promise tax cuts. My question is, how do you plan to reduce the class size of our schools by reducing tax revenue of our state?
Why don't we go to Norm Coleman on that one?
I'll jump into that. We set aside, the legislature appropriated, I think, $230 million in the last biennium for reduction of class size. Go to teachers and parents and ask them, where's the reduction? The answer isn't always more money. The answer is to use more money efficiently. Well, as I said, we spent $23 billion in the biannual budget of the state.
in my tax plan, which I give back $3.1 billion over 4 years, I accommodate full growth in education and human services. But the answer isn't always more money. It's using the money you have more efficiently. That's really the challenge of government as we enter the next millennium, and that's what I will be committed to. As mayor of St. Paul, I kept a lid on spending, and I will do that and deliver better service at less cost.
Jesse Ventura?
Well, it was Jesse Ventura and Mae Schunk that discovered the money that was supposed to go out for those smaller class sizes. We brought it into focus first. It's actually, I believe, about $400 million covering the last 5 or 6 years that has actually been designated by law to go out and do that purpose. But there's loopholes in the law, so when it gets out there, it's being used for other purposes. That is how Jesse Ventura will lower those class sizes, tightening up that law, making them use the money that's designed for lower class sizes to do just that.
Mr. Humphrey.
Well, I would just say this, that obviously the dollars were appropriated for that purpose, but when school districts in, whether it's Maple Grove or elsewhere or up in Crookston, are starving for the resources that are needed just to run their school districts, they may use it for other purposes. And that's what the challenge has been. What we need to do, and I'm the only candidate that has put forth a plan that not only does provide the tax cut, but does invest dollars additionally to lower those class sizes. It's absolutely critical. With all due respect to my colleagues who are here, they may talk a good game, but they have not said to you that they are going to put any additional dollars accounted for responsibly to see that it actually goes to reduce those class sizes. The reason you have all of the local property tax levies going up is because there are insufficient funds coming from the state of Minnesota to support. So what we need to do is make sure that we put a proper level of investment for lower class sizes in the school system.
Let's go off to Lucille's Kitchen in North Minneapolis, Vusi Zulu and his folks there.
Hello, my name is Liz Samuels, and I'm from Lucille's Kitchen in North Minneapolis. And our question is, since most high-crime neighborhoods have best quality housing, how can we use tax incentives to help homeowners and landlords to improve their property and their neighborhoods? Possibly government could give some kind of break in the tax or some kind of levy might be applied.
What you do in Brooklyn Park, by the way, Mayor Ventura?
Well, what you got to do first is you got to lower the taxes across the board, and that makes it better. And then you got to have your local jurisdiction. You know, this is fine for a governor to sit and talk about what should go on in local government, but you have mayors and city councils. That's their job to run their cities accordingly. And so I would say that in its own way, you have to have your mayor and your own city council handle that local jurisdiction of what happens of holding these people responsible for what they do with their local laws and local ordinances.
Skip Humphrey?
Of course, if you ask the mayor and the city council to do that, about the only tool they have is the property tax itself. And so what we need to do is provide, yes, incentives indeed. We need to work with landlords. We need to work with tenants to make sure that we have the full opportunity to provide local incentive for better housing. But you also need an investment in good, affordable housing. And that's one of the things that Roger Moe and I have set forth in our budget, that we want to see the opportunity to work with various foundations and other organizations, with local cities and others, to see that we provide the kind of affordable housing so that when people are coming off of welfare, are going to the job, that they have a decent place in which to live, to raise their family and their children. That's critical. As I visited with a number of people at Lucille's, it's terribly important that we provide that kind of transition housing that allows them to have an even more successful life.
I do want, as you listen to the Attorney General's response tonight, you will hear the word investment for every time that there is a problem. I think we've heard it three times in three questions. Investment is spending. At a certain point in time, if you keep spending, you will then have holes in your budget. You will then be forced to raise taxes. And then government won't be able to deliver on the basic promises that it needs to deliver on. So you got to be very, very careful about that. We do need to clearly be involved, and we've done that in the city of St. Paul. I'm an urban mayor. I deal with this problem. We work, by the way, it is about cutting taxes. It is about making sure that regulation doesn't make it more difficult to have the kind of investment that landlords and others have to make in properties. In addition, you do work with the private sector. And it's not, by the way, just an urban issue. In greater Minnesota, this is an economic development issue. Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, work with folks like McKnight, work with folks like Blanding Corporation, work with the private sector that has a real interest in this nowadays. So I think there are a range of tools, range of options. It's not just, though, another government program.
Let's go up to the North One, Jim Newman, and his friends up in Duluth. Jim? Jim Newman. Somebody in Duluth.
Go.
Hi, my name is Kathy Bennett from Duluth, Minnesota. Where does the middle class, us overtaxed middle class Minnesotans, those with annual income $30,000 to $80,000 a year, fit into your tax plan? What incentives or tax breaks do you have for us? And be specific, those with no children or those whose children have flown the nest, and those of us who don't own property.
Well, I think we ended with the mayor, so we'll start with you first. And then
okay, Kat, I'll love to start on that one. If you look at the Coleman tax cut, it cuts taxes across the board for middle-class families. So it's both the lowest bracket, which is $24,000 under, which is a targeted tax cut under the Attorney General's plan, and then across the board, so middle-income families get the tax cut. And I do it that way. Under the Humphrey plan, if you don't have kids in daycare, and if you don't have kids in college, and if you're not taking care of your parents, you're going to be a loser. You'll be a loser because the only tax cut will be targeted then at those families making $24,000 under, which he calls working families. Kathy, I believe if you're making $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, you're a working family. And under the Coleman tax plan, you'll have that tax will be cut, the marriage penalty tax will be gone, and the sick tax, the tax you pay to doctors when you go to clinics, will all be gone.
Well, unfortunately, Mr. Coleman doesn't know what my tax plan is. The first fact is that there'll be over $1 billion overall of income tax cuts, over $340 million worth of property tax cuts, remember. No other candidate is suggesting that. But first and foremost, there is an overall tax cut in the tax rate for every single taxpayer. And the average tax that unfortunately tax cut that you get under Mr. Coleman's is about $33. Now, some people get upwards of $123,000 under that tax plan. In fact, my tax plan is targeted directly at you and at middle-income individuals. Yes, indeed, we do target some assistance to those who the tax cuts for those families who have children in daycare and child care. We do provide the opportunity for those kids going on to college and senior citizens, those of you who are taking care of your mother or father. We provide those additional tax cuts there where we really know working families need that help.
All right, Jesse Ventura.
Well, you notice when you listen to Mr. Humphrey in every question, he has a program available. There's always going to be a program available. Then when it turns around, he's also going to cut taxes.
That's right.
Now, that's remarkable to me. That must tell me that our government has so much money over there, and they have so overtaxed us and must have built up such a huge amount of pork like they did in Brooklyn Park. Let me give you an example. Brooklyn Park, they wanted to raise a tax. I opposed it, and the tax was because we were going to be $340,000 on our budget the next year. When I investigated, I found out the city of Brooklyn Park was sitting on $63 million in investment money. And apparently that must be what Mr. Humphrey knows is out there, because I don't know how on earth you're going to cut everyone's taxes and then on the other hand provide a new program and programs for everyone under the planet. It's remarkable.
Well, you know, Kathy, the way that you do this is you set forth a plan, an agenda, a budget. Ladies and gentlemen, you got to understand, neither of these candidates on either side of me have provided you any kind of plan that shows what the priorities are. What the priorities are and what you've decided not to do.
I think we'll come back
to this. And that's what we're doing.
We track worth investments
in education and cut taxes. And indeed, you can do that if you decide not to do stadiums and other kinds of things.
We're going to talk about this definitely later on.
For the next few minutes, we're going to turn our attention to some economic issues, and we start with the farm crisis as seen through the eyes of Carolyn Weber of Crookston.
Carolyn Weber calls herself a recovering farmer. She and her husband, Dan, loved farming, but the problems grew. In 1995, too much rain brought crop disease, and on top of that, the global market created a free fall in prices.
How many years in a row can you continue to lose on your net worth and continue to do what you do? The difficult part of that is that it's not just the business, it's a whole lifestyle.
Then at age 39, Dan had a heart attack. Today, the Webbers are only tending a small fraction of their land. Carolyn is getting a degree at the University of Minnesota in Crookston.
Today, I realized that there's more to life than production agriculture, and that you can even be, I'm happy doing the things that I'm doing.
But many of Carolyn's neighbors are less lucky. With corn prices down by a third this year, an acre costs about $300 a plant, but brings only $200 on the market. That means farms on the auction block and more poverty in rural Minnesota.
Good evening. My name is Kristen Weber, and I'm a lifelong Crookston resident. If elected governor, what is your vision for economic growth and recovery here in the northwest region of the state, specifically addressing the issue of agriculture, including farmers who choose to continue to produce food, as well as farmers seeking to transition to other careers?
You want to take a crack at that, Justin Ventura?
Well, first of all, again, high taxes are high taxes, whether you're up in Crookston, down in the urban center, southern Minnesota, the Iron Range. We pay too much in taxes straight across the board. You lower that, more people have more money. Also, you've got to allow farmers to diversify more. And you need to allow them to advance the sales tax and allow other farm to make it broader so that when farmers buy equipment designated for farming, they benefit from that sales tax, which they're break that they're not getting right now. It's very narrowly scoped right now. We need to open that up more. And I've come out openly and said, what is matter with industrial hemp? There's a product that will create new jobs. In World War II, there was a videotape called Hemp for Victory where the government itself wanted to produce hemp because you can make clothing and create new jobs. It's a tremendous plant that can be used to diversify the farms and allow the farmer to expand much more.
Yeah, three things, Carolyn, that need to be done right away. And two of these, by the way, clear difference between myself and the Attorney General. One, farmers need to sell their product. You got to support Fast Track. I mean, it is about selling product. You got to be able to do that. And two, you do not need moratoriums on livestock. Livestock are the original value added. They eat grain. And the grain farmers throughout Minnesota know that if we put moratoriums on livestock, we hurt not just the livestock industry, but the grain industry, the trucking industry, and the grain processing industry. And again, clear difference between myself and the Attorney General on that issue. And then the third thing is really the interesting part of the question. Beyond just what we do in kind of grain farming, you got to get into kind of the next level of production. You got to get into value added. That's why the way over at the University of Minnesota Crookston, we work with folks at ORI, Agricultural Utilization Research Institute, to identify other products, identify value added opportunities for farmers, and let them get into the second stage. That's where you make the profit, not selling raw grain. So if you do that, I believe we can have a brighter future.
General Humphrey.
Well, let me just say this. First of all, to my colleagues, you got to understand that you're not going to have any taxes to pay if you haven't got a market to sell in. If you're losing your farm, you're losing your farm. And when you have 19-cent pork, I think, today, hogs today at 19 cents, you're not the global markets have collapsed. So, number one, we need to make sure that in Washington we're addressing a key concern of reforming that Freedom to Farm Act. That is being done in Washington. A governor can have a direct role and be involved in that. But secondly, we can make sure that we allow producers, farmer producers, to stay on the land, and that's what I've called for, an immediate halt of that property tax that has to be paid in November of this year, not of 1999, but of this year, so that you can actually have farm income available for the next planting season. Now, to make sure we diversify the off-farm income, Roger Moe and I have provided an opportunity to have a revolving fund working with the private and the public sector to diversify the kind of production that is made here as well as at Crookston. I think that's a very important point to expand the off-farm income base.
We're going to go from Crookston to Lucille's Kitchen in Minneapolis. Go ahead with your question.
Hello, this is Fancy Ray McClung, the People's Champion Party on the ballot here in the state of Minnesota, and I wish I was there with you three gentlemen. I am the only person of color in this governor's race, and I wish I was there. You know, when I first got in the race, they thought I was going to be doing jokes and buffoon kind of stuff, and they said, he's talking about issues that's important to people of color. And what you guys do, you guys ignore me. You ignore, like you've ignored the 50% of African Americans who live below the poverty line, like you ignore drugs, like you ignore AIDS until they come to your
Fancy
community.
Ray, what's your
I want to know is this. What I want to know is this. I'm speaking for the blacks and the browns and the red, the brown and the yellow, little kids out there living in poverty. What are you going to do about the 50% of all African-Americans who live below the poverty line here in the state of Minnesota? What are you going to do about that?
All right.
What are you going to do about that?
General Humphrey, take that question.
Well, first and foremost, the most important thing that anyone can do for themselves as well as for the state is to give themselves the opportunity of a solid, good public education. So critical to that is investing in our public schools, lowering that class size, making sure that you have the kind of training so that you can get the job. We've talked about the fact that we want individuals to move from welfare below the poverty line up to and beyond the poverty line, and what we need is the training for that to take place, and that starts with good public education,
okay,
solid families, decent affordable housing, decent transportation so that you can actually get to the job.
So it's all
together. All fits within that so that it allows people to come outside of the framework of a poverty-ridden area.
Mayor Coleman.
I deal with these issues on a regular basis. I'm an urban mayor in a city that was on its knees 5 years ago and is doing a heck of a lot better today. Skip's right, by the way, though, about education. I mean, that really is the base. You got to start there. You got to be innovative, creative, strong, quality public education, charter schools as a part of that, merit pay and a range of other things. But in addition to that, you got to make sure there are jobs. You got to grow jobs. And that's what I have done as mayor. Then the challenge is connect, Ray, the people with the jobs. The jobs are out there. We have to do a better job of connecting. And if there has been an area of change in St. Paul that's probably been the most dynamic, it's really been the way we've dealt with what we call workforce development, connecting people with jobs, going out into the community, and working with employers, identifying what are the skills that are needed, and then connect people to those jobs. If you do that, you create opportunity.
Jobs, training, education, what do you think?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say when I left and started my career, I'm from South Minneapolis, also born and raised right in the heart of Minneapolis. I left with $200 in my pocket, a beat-up Chevy, and lived in a hotel $2,250 a week. So I know what it's like to start at the bottom. But if you've got personal, good perseverance, you want to advance yourself, and you believe in yourself, I believe that anyone can help themselves, and there shouldn't be obstacles in the way. I find it interesting, Mayor Coleman, talking about St. Paul. I visited the World Trade Center. The place is literally empty over there, about 15% filled over there. I don't see all these jobs that are over there in St. Paul all the time. But again, what it gets down to, Ray, is personal perseverance on yourself, government not being in the way, and people being able to go out there, educate themselves, and continue on in a life, because you can do it if you believe that you can.
I just want to jump in. Actually, Jesse, the World Trade Center, the job portion is 98% filled, and that's up about 30% when I took over.
Well, about 15% filled in the building.
No,
that's 75%,
85% filled.
This is maybe not that profitable.
Let's take over. Let's take a walk over and look.
Off to Duluth. Jim Newman, go ahead.
Good evening. I'm Barb Sanderson from Grand Rapids. My question is a two-part one. First, do you personally know a homeless person, or have you been directly involved in a program that serves homeless people? And second, what will you do as governor to prevent homelessness in Minnesota?
Jesse Ventura, you know a homeless person?
No, I don't. But what I have done, though, I remember Matt Blair a couple years ago got a bunch of us together, and we took photographs and put out a book that was sold on the market, and all of that money went to help the homeless people. And I know one of the greatest things that I felt was last Thanksgiving, I went to the Salvation Army kitchen and served food, and I met a man there that day serving food, and he came up to me this year at the state fair. I didn't even recognize him, because he was well-dressed now, and he came up and shook my hand and said, "Thank you, Mr. Ventura. You inspired me when you fed me over at that day over at the Salvation Army last year." And he said, "I've got a job now, and I'm doing terrific." So I guess he would count. I don't know him by name,
but he's
not homeless anymore.
General Humphrey.
You know, the most recent opportunities I've had to work with homeless is the Vietnam Veterans Stand Down. I had a chance to visit and to attend the stand down and to talk with a number of Vietnam veterans that are homeless. And they were there getting information from a number of different organizations, nonprofit organizations, some for-profit companies were there. The state of Minnesota was involved. The city of Minneapolis with its housing program was involved. That's the kind of initiative of bringing the entire community together, trying to make sure that we are fitting not only our private life commitment, but our public life commitment to any number of individuals that have major problems.
In fact, I forgot I was there helping them put up tents that day also.
Okay, and then Mayor Coleman.
Again, my experience as an urban mayor, these are things that you deal with, and you deal with them. And I have, working with Dorothy Day Center in St. Paul, Catholic Charities, Union Gospel Mission. One of the most rewarding experiences for me as mayor was when I spoke at the graduation ceremony at the Union Gospel Mission for 8 women who graduated from a program that was going to connect them with jobs. These were women who had been homeless. And I went then to a school, sat in school a couple weeks later, and kids were sitting on the floor, and one came up to me and said, "You were at my mom's graduation." The fact is, it all gets back to connecting people with opportunity, making sure that there are jobs, and once you got the jobs, makes the connections. That's what I have done in St. Paul, and that's an issue that I think is relevant throughout Minnesota.
We have another question from right here in the studio. Karen Louise Booth from Minnesota Public Radio has that.
I'm with Lisa Tubbs of Rosemount. What's your question?
A great number of single parents with small children are on welfare. Many of these families would probably not need this assistance if the other spouse or parent were not an absentee and failing to contribute to the family. What ideas do you have to address this problem and be specific?
General Humphrey? That's right. You did a good job.
Well, number one, I thank you for that question. Obviously, in my role as Attorney General, one of the things that I did was to get the legislature to come right directly at the situation of where the other parent is not making those child support payments. I want to see that doubled. I think that we can perhaps provide at least another $10 million through that process if we can make it even more efficient. So that's critical. Now, the other part of this is as you are a single parent and you're going off to work, is to make sure that you have the opportunity for your child to be in learning-based daycare. And I want to make certain of that by providing a tax cut that will give you the resources to give you the full opportunity to choose what is that best place for your child to be during the time that you're working.
What about deadbeat parents, Jesse Ventura?
Well, absolutely, deadbeat parents. You know, the thing is, the child becomes the pawn in the fight between the parents. The parents have to themselves accept responsibility that the child is the most important person in this particular relationship. You go after the deadbeat parent, you make them pay, but on the same token, you also have to make sure that money is going to the child. You know, it's a give and take on both sides, because I hear the other side of the issue too, where you have the non-custodial parent is paying, and they don't always feel that their money is directly being used, by, you know, for the benefit of that child. So you've got to find the medium, and the parents have to take personal responsibility. Just because they didn't get along doesn't mean they use that child, and that child becomes a pawn in the game. It took two to make that child. It takes two to support that child.
Mayor Coleman.
Jesse's right. This is a matter of responsibility. And sometimes the government's got to get involved in this case to enforce some of that responsibility. And as an ex-prosecutor, that's something I understand. The county attorneys have been very, very, very aggressive in this area, and they should be, because it's important, and kids need the support of both parents. Skip also mentioned the question of daycare. And that is a major issue. You've got to be careful, though, when you talk about education-based daycare. There are a lot of private daycare providers out there who now are being threatened by rules and regulations and Department of Families, Children and Learning. Let's make sure that we support the broad range of child care so parents have a broad range of options.
All right. Minnesota voters, by the way, have identified education as the biggest issue this campaign season. How to stay in school and get a well-paying job are two questions on the mind of Tarenda Brown of Minneapolis.
A third of Minnesota students are failing their standardized tests. Among minority students, the failure rate is twice that. But grades are the least of Tarenda Brown's problems. She's an A student, and she plans to keep it that way.
Because it's a challenge. I like to be challenged. I don't like to learn the same basic stuff over and over again.
Tarenda's mother takes care of Tequila, a 16-month-old baby, while she's in school. Tequila's father was murdered last year, leaving Tarenda to raise her child alone.
I had to get my education so I can get a good job, make a good living so I can support her, because it's just me, nobody else. As soon as I finish high school, I'm going straight to college.
Determination, even in the face of difficulties, could make the difference for Tarenda and for other students struggling to get a good education.
My name is Miranda Brown. I attend the City Northside School. I have a very short three-part question. Please answer the first two parts with only a true or false. You have an opportunity to give a longer answer to the third question. True or false, segregation lowers student achievement. True or false, community schools increase segregation. If the schools stay segregated with low student achievement, are you prepared to mediate the NAACP lawsuit, or will you be the governor responsible for having the court take over metropolitan schools?
Mayor Coleman Tarrant is a good moderator.
She's a good moderator. I'm going to have to bend the rules a little bit, and I'll do them in reverse order. Community schools are a positive thing.
Do they increase segregation, she said?
I think they increase opportunity for all kids, and segregation per se is something that is bad, but there are schools that are African-American schools. Seed Academy in Minneapolis doing an outstanding job with young African-American
kids. True or false, though? Community schools increase segregation?
False.
Okay.
False. Well, when you say community schools are a good thing, they are a good thing, and they may in certain areas, if in fact you have concentrations of a particular group of color in a community, the answer is still have the community school, but put the resources in there. Make it a quality school. You know, in St. Paul, I have kids, Southeast Asian kids, that are bused all the way across town, and moms and dads never have a chance to be involved in their school.
You want to mediate the NAACP lawsuit?
No, I don't. I think you litigate that. I disagree with the lawsuit. I am a strong proponent of community-based schooling. I support Mayor Sells Belton on that. Forced busing has not helped kids.
Do I get the same true and false response?
Let me
just say, first of all, I want to say thank you. You are a hero. What you are trying to accomplish in your life, you are taking the energy, and you are a great example of what can be accomplished when the entire community comes together. But with regard to community schools, I think community schools work so long as you have the full range of options of charter schools, alternative learning centers, and the transportation system to allow you to get to the best education that you need on your own basis. If it's the community school where you live, yes. But if that school is in some other place, you ought to have that full range of opportunity, too. So then it doesn't destroy.
Increase segregation, true or false?
It doesn't increase segregation if that is the case. Now, if you have those options. With regard to segregation itself, I think that definitely detracts from education. The third thing is about mediation. Absolutely mediate this effort. Reduce the conflict. There will be places in that lawsuit that we need to litigate. But this idea that lawyers should be going head over heels over it is ridiculous. I don't agree with that. I don't agree with Governor Carlson, and I certainly don't agree with Norm Coleman on that. He knows as well as I do that in our Office of Attorney General, we try and mediate as best as we possibly can before we litigate.
And you are on mediation. All right, we'll write that down. Jesse Ventura, what do you think?
False.
Okay, community schools.
I went to school in the city of Minneapolis, and again, we've got to get back to neighborhood schools. And I believe this wholeheartedly, because when you're busing kids all around town, there's no chance for the parents to be involved in the process then. There's no chance for a strong PTA. You've got to have a strong parent-teacher association. We had that at Roosevelt High School when I went to Roosevelt High School.
But times are changing, though.
The times aren't changing. The times changed for the worst. Not always the future makes it better. Sometimes the past can be better, too. And I believe strongly the school then becomes the focal point of that community as well as the churches. You develop then a pride in that neighborhood because you know everyone in that neighborhood knows each other. You get involved together, and you build strength all the way across the board.
Mediate.
All right.
Let's go to Duluth and another question. Thanks for waiting. Hello.
Good evening. My name is Sharon Mott. I'm from Duluth, Minnesota. And our question is twofold tonight. Under your administration, this is for each one of you, under your administration, where would education decisions be made? In Washington, St. Paul, or in our home communities? We would also like your specific stand on school choice, which includes charter and parochial schools, portability of public funds per student, higher education funding support, and we'd appreciate hearing specific answers.
Okay, there's a lot to chew on there.
First of all, they want them to shorten them up and they
ask. Yeah, I know. Okay. Actually, where would education decisions be made? Washington, Minnesota, local?
Not Washington. I would say Minnesota and local, possibly with a combination of both. You know, you hear a lot of criticism about profiles and learning and goals 2000, all that. Well, it's the law. It's implemented. But, and there's good and bad to it. We need to judge it accordingly and look at it. But the one thing it does, it brings some credibility to the teachers, too. It makes them get judged on the job that they're doing also. And the bottom line is the kids seem to like it. And isn't that half the battle? If kids like to learn, they're going to learn. But I believe very strongly local jurisdiction to make local judgment in the school process.
All right. Tell you what, let's go to each gentleman and ask about where decisions will be made and go back to school choice, okay?
Sure. The decisions for school responsibility ought to be right where it is today. It ought to be in the independent school district, at the local level, in the community, with the families and that area. Now, obviously, the state of Minnesota has a responsibility to provide substantial financial assistance to that in the form of the student formula.
Okay. Mayor Coleman.
It absolutely needs to be made at the local level. And you know, the litmus test here is profiles. And if both Skip and Jesse say we're going to support the profile, then what you've done is you've got bureaucrats in St. Paul and Washington imposing mandates on teachers and parents at the local level. I'd love to free teachers from the bureaucratic mandates and let them do what they do best is teach, get parents involved at the local level, site-based management. But profile is a good litmus test question there. That should be done at the local level. Let them decide.
Then there's no accountability.
Yeah, we need to have statewide standards, but we need to have the input come up from the bottom, not top down. And if you move away from whether you call it profiles or any other thing, then basically you don't have that accountability for the resources, the $23 billion that you're talking about. We've got to know whether or not we're getting our money's worth. Bottom line.
Accountability, but you let parents and teachers tell us how we're going to reach those standards.
Absolutely.
You don't have the state do that. And the profiles are the curriculum piece. Let's have the high standards, but let's put parents and teachers
in charge. Now, our friends in Duluth asked about school choice. I'm going to start with the mayor and then go back down this way.
I strongly support school choice. And we have a system in Minnesota, which is a wonderful system, education tax credits and deductions, in which parents, if parents of kids in public school, and by the way, 70% of the dollars in the education tax credit deduction program goes to parents of kids in public school, but every parent can buy a computer for their kid. Every parent can use tutoring. So I strongly support that, and in fact, in my budget, I expand that school choice option.
That's the first time I heard he had a budget. Yeah, they're interesting. The reality is that I want to see full school choice within the public education system, but I do not want to see us further undermine the opportunity for a proper investment in school choice, whether it's a charter school, an alternative learning center, a community education facility, whatever, a community school. We need to have those, but if we're undermining that by moving and siphoning away the dollars into the private sector, we're not going to provide the kind of dollars for that, smaller class sizes and the other kinds of things that need to be done in those schools.
I support the public school system. I'm a product of it in Minnesota. I sent my children to public schools. Absolutely, I support public schools to make them better. And I fully support choice. If people want a homeschool, that's up to them. That's fine. If they want charter school, that's fine. Support that. If they want to go to private school, they certainly can do that, too, if they so choose to do so.
Another question here in our St. Paul studios. Let's go to Lori Sturdivant. Lori?
I'm here with Sharon Bransford from North St. Paul.
Hi. As governor, what would you do to further the ideals and the concept of early childhood development so that all children are entering kindergarten on an even playing field?
Jesse Ventura, and we'll go back around.
Well, first of all, that's called parenting. You know, from the time that your child is born till kindergarten, that falls on the responsibility of the parent. And I certainly don't want government to be in the birthing room. You know, there to take your baby from you and start government education at that point in time. I believe that falls on individual responsibility of parents to prepare their children in that early age so that they're ready to go to kindergarten when they do get to kindergarten through 12, the public school system.
General Humphrey.
Well, that's a great question, and I thank you. We need to make sure that we're helping our parents with good parenting skills. That's what ECFE is all about. We need to make sure that we are providing the opportunity for quality child care because we all have learned, the research shows very clearly, that the child's brain is growing at about 90% in those first 3 or 4 years. We need to be able to help parents make the right decisions and give them the full opportunity for an exciting start, a head start. The Head Start program is a perfect example. Early Head Start is another good example of bringing the whole family together, working to see that we get that first start so that by the time they get to kindergarten, they're already learning. They're not in the situation of having to remediate.
My parents didn't need that, Skip.
You know, the fact
my
is,
parents did
you
their
know,
job.
There's quite a few people that do need it. Okay. Your parents maybe both didn't work.
Yes, they both did.
Well, then maybe they did.
Well,
but the reality is that there are many people that need that help and assistance, Jesse, and I think you've got
to
invest.
To do it. Okay.
And that's what Roger Mose and my budget provides additional funds to help make sure that we have those kinds
Mayor
of efforts.
Mayor Coleman wants to weigh in here.
Start with strong families. That's where you start. Make sure that mom and dad has a job. Make sure that there's opportunity. That's really where it begins. There are some good programs out there. The EFSA program, the Head Start program, and by the way, in the $23 billion budget we fund those. That's a good thing.
Right.
There's even growth in those. It's not a matter of more programs and new programs. Strong families first and foremost, and then there are some very good programs that continue to be supported. In addition, get the church groups involved, get the faith community involved, get the foundation and private sector involved. There are a lot of resources we can bring to the table to build strong families.
I started Head Start in Brooklyn Park, too, for those that want to know.
There you go. Thank you, gentlemen. We're about halfway through the show, and we want to take a few minutes here to give the citizens a chance to regroup. That'll give Kathy and me an opportunity to grill the candidates one-on-one. First up is Norm Coleman, and all of you at home have just enough time now to run into the kitchen and get a refreshing soft drink. We'll be back in about 30 seconds.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio.
Back. Eric and I get to grill the candidates one-on-one for a few minutes while we all kind of relax and take a deep breath. Mayor Coleman, I'm going to throw a question here to you. I know you're against same-sex marriage. You're on the record about that. But what if your son or daughter came to you and said, Dad, I'm gay or I'm lesbian? What would you want society to do for your child? How would you want society to treat your child?
I'd want them to be treated with dignity. I'd want them to have opportunity. But I don't think government has to come in and recognize same-sex marriage. I don't think government has to come in and take this official action. Let people live their lives. What would be the difference if my child came in and said that, or my child came in and said, you know, I got a boyfriend? Live your life. Live in a free society. Have opportunity. I want them to have quality education, a quality job. I want them to live in a safe community. But you don't need government coming in, for instance, and say, we're going to recognize same-sex marriage. We really should hold up the family as an ideal. And I believe that that's the appropriate course of action. But if they came in and said, I'd be a loving dad, I'd say whatever I can do to support you, I'd do that. But you don't need government action.
Now, you oppose abortion. You as a governor, you could be appointing 60, 70, 80, 90 judges. Litmus test for your judicial appointments, must they oppose abortion as you do?
The litmus test for judges is to be quality people, integrate. I would say this, don't be social activists. I don't believe judges should get in there and create laws. I will appoint people who understand that their responsibility, Eric, is to interpret the Constitution. But there are no litmus tests on an issue.
So
what you do is what...
Pro-choice judge would be...
I would look at their integrity, and I'd look at their commitment to not try to make law, to simply to interpret the Constitution, do the job that they're appointed to do. But I will not ask my appointees their position on particular issues, Eric.
Say, earlier this week, Mayor, critics contended that St. Paul doesn't always follow a city policy, that businesses receiving city funds are not creating jobs that pay above the poverty line, the livable wage situation in St. Paul. How do you respond to that?
We have 8,000 new jobs. I think I announced another 1,000 today. Living wage is not an issue for these jobs. I mean, the fact is, and in fact, living wage today, because of the abundance of the issue is connecting people to jobs, Kathy. We're not even worried about minimum wage that much anymore. I mean, McDonald's is...
Allegedly, some areas of the city are not following this city ordinance, though. And you're
not coming up with the money for the wages.
We have a city resolution that is in place, and you have critics out there. But, Kathy, let me tell you, we have created thousands of jobs. The people of St. Paul are happy with those jobs, and I think the critics are simply dead wrong.
Property taxes, the Attorney General has a property tax plan. You've concentrated on income tax. So what about our property tax burden? What's going to happen to that under Governor Coleman?
Well, first, sir, you start with what you can do right away, which is income tax. We're the second highest tax state in the country. We have a lot of other taxes that I will work morning, noon, and night to cut Minnesota taxes.
Property
taxes. But it's what the Attorney General's plan, which says that two things. One, we'll buy off more of the state funding of education, is a false promise. That lowers property taxes in the short term, but then when local spending goes up, you get hit with a double whammy. Increase state taxes, increase local. I will look at property taxes. I will work to reform the system, but I'm not going to make promises there I can't keep.
Okay.
Go and relax now. We'll do that.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Appreciate your time. Thanks. Jesse Ventura, you've gotten a lot of mileage out of challenging and questioning the size of state government. Should there be a lot of aid and subsidies for tuition? Should there be subsidies for child care? Yet, at the end of this campaign, you're going to get 5%. You're going to get a check for $310,000 from whom? State taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the right priority for our tax dollars to go into your party's pocket?
Well, it went into the other two parties' pockets, too, didn't it? What's good for the goose is good for the gander. I mean, Mr. Coleman got his the day after the primary. I didn't get mine until a week ago. It's a program that's out there.
Do you like public financing, or should they be out there getting the money the old-fashioned way?
Well, I personally would like to see it go in some aspects to complete public financing, because what that would do, it would eliminate special interest and PAC money and the buying and selling of our politicians out there, because if everyone were given an equal amount of money and then say, okay, this is what you get, spend it as you will, then you wouldn't have selling of your soul to special interest group, which turns November 3rd into an auction rather than an election.
What is the proper role of government? I ask you, this is kind of along the vein of what Eric is getting at, maybe. You're in favor of light rail, yet you came out this week and you're not too excited about sliding fee daycare in terms of the role of government. Both, it seems odd.
I'm not against a lot of programs. What I want to see is this. Programs get put in with no sunset clause. I mean, they're implemented and they're never looked at again. They're just funded and funded and funded. I think every program should be required to have a sunset provision in it, so that no matter what that program is, it must be reevaluated at some time. If it's working, fine. If it's not working, get rid of it. But right now, I think we've got far too many programs that are never looked at again, and they just become endless pits of money, and that's why we're the second highest tax state in the nation.
In the last pre-primary debate, Senator Doug Johnson, running for governor at the time, suggested that if crime was bad in certain parts of the state, he'd be willing to call in the National Guard or the Reserve to do some police-type work. You have a military background. On that and a broader issue, what do you see as an expanded role, if any, for National Guard type of personnel?
Well, the National Guard is brought in when it's an emergency. I mean, you would need rioting in the streets and have it uncontrollable to where the local police, it's out of hand in that. National Guard's role is for disasters, things of that nature, the flooding up north, when the tornado goes through St. Peter. Yes, you use the National Guard then to come in to provide security, provide relief and help, make sure that crime doesn't happen, because many times with a disaster, what follows it? Unfortunately, looting and things of that nature.
Not as a crime-fighting force.
Oh, no, that's your last resort, and I will say this, if they call me and then get out of the way. because it'll be my way or the highway.
Speaking of highway, how about toll roads? Where are you on toll roads?
Toll roads, I oppose them completely. Toll roads are like a cancer. The minute you get one, everybody in the world then, when they want some money, will put a toll on a road. We don't need toll roads. They slow down traffic. They cause congestion. I've lived out in New York City. I know what toll roads are like, and I don't like them at all, and we don't need them in Minnesota. In fact, let's open up those same lanes. We paid for them. Let's open them up so we can drive on them so that we can relieve that pressure.
MnDOT says 394 would be a parking lot if you did that.
It's a parking lot now with one open lane. Right now you've got a parking lot out there, and then you've got a lane that's not being used, that sits there with nothing on it. The parking lot's a parking lot. Hey, three lanes are going to move better than two. Four will move better than three.
I just heard the bell.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Skip Humphrey, you have been endorsed by the MEA, the MFT, now known as Education Minnesota, I believe. What do you think about mandatory testing of teachers?
Well, I've talked to many teachers, and they think that there ought to be high standards for their own profession. I'd be happy to look at the question of whether it's mandatory or not, but I know that they themselves are already in the process of setting up new standards. They want an internal process that says, hey, we are going to have high-quality teachers. This is a profession. We expect to meet professional standards. I think that's terribly important. So whether it's mandatory, I don't know whether necessarily we need to have mandatory, but we need to encourage teachers to set their own very high standards and then to have citizens and parents get involved in review of that process. We need to know, are we going to meet those high goals and standards? Everybody's got to be held accountable, teachers and parents and students, administrators. The state of Minnesota's got to be held accountable to provide the resources. I mean, that's real important, Kathy.
Rudy Perfect said that the news media coverage of his travels really took away his passport. I wonder, as Governor Humphrey, how much are you going to travel and what kind of guidelines are you going to have for who pays for it, where do you go, how do you get there, that sort of stuff?
Gads, Eric, I've never even thought about it. But I want you to know, I've had the opportunity to travel and to take trade missions to Sweden. I've taken a trade mission to Israel, to England. I think it's terribly important. We're now doing business, more business, in this state because of each one of those trade missions. It's very important that we make the connections back and forth throughout the world. We all talk about a global market. Well, guess what? We got to make those connections. And a governor ought to be able to let the people know in other parts of the world, hey, come and take a look at Minnesota. We got something we can show you, and we'd like to do business both ways. We also need to learn about the other opportunities in those countries. But, you know, we got a great place right in the United States. Let's go showcase our state in the United States. This is a pretty good market right here.
What do you think? You were talking a couple weeks ago about the correction system in Minnesota.
Yes.
And maybe doing some cutting in that particular department. What do you think about, say, the Appleton prison, private prisons, privately run prisons?
I don't think we need to privatize. In fact, what I told the legislature when they asked that question, I said, you have to look out. There is a huge problem of risk of taxpayers having the risk of liability suits against them and all the rest without being able to have the kind of control mechanisms. In fact, I shared that with many of my fellow attorneys general, and they came back and said, wow, Skip, we're glad you looked at this. This is a serious problem. But on the other hand, I have talked with employees of the corrections department, and all of them say, look, we can do a better job. We can do it at lower cost. We know of ways in which we can improve the system, and we want to work with you. You need a governor that's willing to engage with the people that are right on the front line that know the business to reduce the cost. Our per cell cost is one of the highest in the nation. We ought to be able to deliver a safe correction system without having all of that high cost. Now, another idea. Why does each state have a correction system?
Why aren't we talking with Wisconsin? Why aren't we talking with the Dakotas? Why don't we share this cost a little bit? You know, someone goes to jail, it's a jail. Let's look regionally about lowering the cost and doing it right and sharing that burden a little bit. That will lower the taxpayers' cost in that. So there's a lot of things that we can do if we engage ourselves. But you have to have a governor that's willing to set priorities in a budget and say, let's get this job done. Now, another part of what I've talked about is a continuous performance review. Let's look at each one of those agencies, see if we can't get it at more efficient at lower cost. You know, when George Bush Jr. did this in Texas, he saved $8 billion.
There you go. We'll leave it right there.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.